once, but in the end none have been found, and I hear they fly away when the thrushes arrive. If only I had known this desire of yours, sire, several weeks ago, when I was racking my brain trying to think of what I could possibly send you that might please you. But never mind. You have been unlucky in the Ortolans, just as I was foiled by the grey partridges because I lost them to the goshawk falcon. The heavy rain made it impossible to set the broad beans in his garden, she said, but fair weather must come again, and with it his return. I send you no pills, because desire makes me hope that you must soon arrive here to claim them in person. I am all eagerness to hear the resolution that will reach you this week. The resolution did not come, however. Galileo grew cranky with waiting, and so dependent on his daughter's letters that he scolded her when they failed to arrive often enough to soothe him. If only you could fathom my soul and its longing the way you penetrate the heavens, sire, she began on November 5th. I feel certain you would not complain of me, as you did in your last letter, because you would see and assure yourself how much I should want, if only it were possible, to receive your letters every day, and also to send you one every day, esteeming this the greatest satisfaction that I could give to and take from you, until it pleases God that we may once again delight in each other's presence. Then she told him how she had secured his coveted Ortolans, after all, through a bird-keeper in the service of the Grand Duke. Any moment now she would dispatch Geppo to the game-rich acres of the Boboli Gardens behind the Pitti Palace, armed with a flowered box in which to pack the delicate birds and deliver them straight away to Signor Geri. But when Galileo thanked her for them a few days later, he said nothing of his own flight from Siena. "I must tell you first how astounded I was," she wrote the following Saturday, November 12th, "that you made no mention in your most recent letter of having received any word from Rome, nor any resolution regarding your return, which we had so hoped to have before All Saints' Day, November 1st, from what Signor Gherardini led me to believe. I want you to tell me truly how this business is progressing, so as to quiet my mind, and also, please, tell me what subject you are writing about at present, provided it is something that I could understand, and you have no fear that I might gossip." Suor Maria Celeste necessarily understood the semi-secret nature of her father's works in progress. In fact, some of the materials removed from Il Gioiello during Galileo's trial concerned his writing on motion, including the manuscript for the third day of Two New Sciences, which he had roughed out before he left for Rome. Although Galileo would not have deemed these particular documents incriminating, he had reason to fear their needless destruction. Day 3's treatment of uniform and accelerated motion bears witness to the untold number of Paduan hours Galileo spent tracking the course of a small bronze ball down the groove of an inclined plane to probe the mystery of acceleration. Unable to experiment fruitfully with freely falling objects, Galileo built his inclined plane apparatus so he could control fall, stopping the action at will, making precise measurements of time and distance all the while. Salviati, who claims in Two New Sciences to have assisted Galileo occasionally in these efforts, describes them to Sagredo and Simplicio. "We rolled the ball along the channel, noting, in a manner presently to be described, the time required to make the descent. We repeated this experiment more than once in order to measure the time with an accuracy such that the deviation between two observations never exceeded 1/10 of a pulse beat. Having performed this operation, and having assured ourselves of its reliability, we now rolled the ball only 1/4 the length of the channel, and having measured the time of its descent, we found it precisely 1/2 of the former. Next we tried other distances, comparing the time for the whole length with that for the half, or with that for 2/3 or 3/4, or indeed for any fraction. In such experiments, repeated a full 100 times, we always found that the spaces traversed were to each other as the squares of the times, and this was true for all inclinations of the plane, along which we rolled the ball." Just as Copernicus had discerned the configuration of the solar system with no telescope to guide him, Galileo arrived at this fundamental relationship between distance and time without so much as a reliable unit of measure or an accurate clock. Italy possessed no national standards in the 17th century, leaving distances open to guesstimate gauging by fleas' eyes, hair breadths, lentil or millet seed diameters, hand spans, arm lengths, and the like. Even a braccio differed in dimension depending on whether it was measured in Florence, Rome, or Venice, and so Galileo delineated his own arbitrary units along the length of his experimental apparatus. As long as these units matched one another, he could use them to establish fundamental relationships. To clock the rolling time of the balls, Galileo literally weighed the moments. For the measurement of time, Salviati continues in his experimental description, we employed a large vessel of water placed in an elevated position. To the bottom of this vessel was soldered a pipe of small diameter, giving a thin jet of water, which we collected in a small glass during the time of each descent, whether for the whole length of the channel or for a part of its length. The water thus collected was weighed, after each descent, on a very accurate balance against grains of sand. The differences and ratios of these weights gave us the differences and ratios of the times, and this with such accuracy that although the operation was repeated many, many times, there was no appreciable discrepancy in the results. Although this account reveals a series of experiments that promised to open a new window on philosophy, Salviati cannot be shaken from his recently acquired pedantic monotone, which threatens to establish an irreparable split, if not between science and religion, then between science and poetry. The ball and plane trials provided the tedious yet triumphant prelude to the truth about falling, which Galileo expressed in Two New Sciences as a series of theorems. He did not use the convention of algebraic analysis that later allowed his rules to be pared down to a few letters and symbols, but expressed his findings as geometric ratios, and wrote out his proofs in dense prose accompanied by letter-labeled line drawings in the style of the ancient Greek mathematicians. All the motions discussed on the third day of Two New Sciences are natural ones, since the experimental objects simply roll or drop instead of being thrown with force. Not until the day four, which Galileo would complete several years later in 1637, do the violent movements of bullets and other projectiles come up for discussion. Here, Galileo displays his singular insight in breaking motions into their separate components. For he shows that any cannonball fired from a mortar, for example, or any arrow shot from a bow, combines two vectors, the uniform forward thrust of the propulsion and the downward acceleration of free fall. One cannot deny that the argument is new, subtle, and conclusive, remarks Sagredo, resting as it does upon this hypothesis, namely, that the horizontal motion remains uniform, that the vertical motion continues to be accelerated downwards in proportion to the square of the time, and that such motions and velocities as these combine without altering, disturbing, or hindering each other, so that as the motion proceeds, the path of the projectile does not change into a different curve. Whatever the weight of the projectile or the force propelling it, Salviati explains on Galileo's say-so, the path traced in space always assumes the curved shape of a parabola. Shooting straight up or down, however, constitutes a separate category, also taken into consideration by the participants. Mere mention of the parabola by Salviati instantly occasions a digression into the geometry of the cone, the parent body of the parabola, for the sake of Sagredo and Simplicio, who fear they may fail to follow a discussion promising such a plethora of parabolas. Your demonstration proceeds too rapidly, complains Simplicio, and it seems to me you keep on assuming that all of Euclid's theorems are as familiar and available to me as his first axioms, which is far from true. But once the shape has been thoroughly examined, to the satisfaction of the less mathematically inclined, the discussion continues easily and amicably. It even allows for an analysis of the efficiency of various angles of elevation of heavy artillery, complete with a geometric proof showing why the 45-degree angle surpasses all others, because the parabola thus described has the greatest possible amplitude, and therefore the shot carries farthest. The force of rigid demonstrations, such as occur only in mathematics, fills me with wonder and delight, Sagredo exclaims at this revelation. From accounts given by gunners, I was already aware of the fact that in the use of cannon and mortars, the maximum range, that is, the one in which the shot goes farthest, is obtained when the elevation is 45, or, as they say, at the sixth point of the quadrant. But to understand why this happens far outweighs the mere information obtained by the testimony of others or even by repeated experiment. This emphasis on the practical application and value of science, so far removed from the metaphysical consideration of causes, set Galileo apart from most philosophers of his time. While Aristotelian philosophers talked of essences and natural places, Galileo went after quantifiable entities such as time, distance, and acceleration. Other contemporary treatises in dialogue form typically situated the speakers around a university quadrangle. Two New Sciences takes place in a shipyard. Its characters simply dismiss the pursuit of ultimate causes that has passed for science until their time. The cause of the acceleration of the motion of falling bodies is not a necessary part of the investigation, declares Salviati. From now on, physics will never be the same. The continuous rain, Suor Maria Celeste wrote in a morning after postscript to her weekly summary of Saturday, November 12th, has not allowed Giovanni, as the bearer of this letter is called, to leave this morning, which is Sunday, and this leaves me time to chat with you a little longer and to tell you that recently I pulled a very large molar which had rotted and was giving me great pain. But what is worse is that I have several others that soon will do the same. She had begun extracting her own teeth years earlier, a self-treatment that must have required heroic determination, and described herself as prematurely toothless when she was only 27. To respond to that personal detail you shared with me, her postscript continued, that you find occupations so salubrious, truly I recognize them as having that same effect on myself as well, so that even though the activities occasionally seem superfluous and intolerable to me, on account of my being a friend of tranquility, I nevertheless see clearly how staying active is the foundation of my health, and particularly in the time that you have been far away from us, sire, with great providence did the Lord arrange it, so that I never had what you might call an hour of peace, thus preventing the oppression of your absence from distressing me. Such grief would have been harmful to me and given you cause for worry instead of the relief I have been able to provide. As Suor Maria Celeste sat writing in the Sunday morning rain of November 13th, Ambassador Nicolini again approached the Pope for permission to send Galileo back to Arcetri. Urban withheld his judgment. He neither granted nor denied the request during this audience, but pointedly led on that he knew Galileo was enjoying the support, defense, companionship, and correspondence of like-minded men, all of whom, Urban assured Nicolini with undisguised disgust, were now under surveillance by the Holy Office. The Archbishop of Siena himself numbered among this company. If good luck had enabled you to find even one gray partridge, Suor Maria Celeste filled the time writing as another week passed without news of her father's homecoming, I would have been thrilled to have it for love of that poor sick young girl who craves nothing but wild game. At the last full moon, she was so ill as to be anointed with holy oil, but now she has made such a comeback that we believe she will live to see the new moon. She speaks with great vivacity and gulps her food readily, provided we give her tasty things. Last night I stayed with her all through the night, and while I fed her she said, "I cannot believe that when one stands on the verge of death, it is possible to eat the way I do, yet for all that I have no desire to turn back, only to see God's will be done." As many times as Suor Maria Celeste must have touched the back of her hand to Suor Maria Silvia's feverish forehead, she had no way to measure the girl's temperature. She could gauge it only relatively, refining her reading by the flush of the patient's complexion, the rapidity of her pulse, and the shallowness of her breathing. Before the week was out, just as the daylight was fading one afternoon at the 24th hour, a messenger arrived from Siena with a pannier full of game birds. Inside it were 12 thrushes. The additional 4, which would have completed the number you state in your letter, sire, must have been liberated by some charming little kitten who thought of tasting them ahead of us because they were not there, and the cloth cover had a large hole in it. How fortunate that the gray partridges and woodcocks were at the bottom, one of which and two thrushes I gave to the sick girl to her great joy, and she thanks you, sire. I sent another gift also, in the form of two thrushes, to Signor Rondinelli, and the remainder we enjoyed together with our friends. I have taken the greatest pleasure in distributing all this bounty among various people, because prizes sought after with such diligence and difficulty deserve to be shared by several, and as the thrushes arrived a little the worse for wear, it was necessary to cook them in a stew, so that I stood over them all day, and for once I truly surrendered myself to gluttony. Chapter 31. Until I have this from your lips. The Wednesday before the start of Advent, when Suor Maria Celeste went searching for the pears Galileo had requested, she briefly imagined saving them to present to him in person, before her doubts dispelled these pleasant thoughts. "Because I hear that this year the fruits do not last long, I wonder if it might be better, once I have them, to send them to you right away and not wait for your return, which could be delayed for several more weeks, or so my desire leads me to fear." By church tradition, the hopeful time of Advent commenced with the Sunday closest to the feast day of St. Andrew the Apostle, November 30th. In 1633, the nearest Sunday happened to fall on November 27th, the earliest possible date for Advent to begin, and this stretched the period to its maximum duration of 28 days. Everything that had anything to do with waiting dilated during the dark season Suor Maria Celeste spent anticipating her father's return. In her breviary, she read the Advent liturgy regarding the Lord, the King that is to come, the Lord already near, and Him whose glory will be seen on the morrow. Inside the tiny church of San Mateo, Suor Barbera prepared the violet-colored candles, the seasonal violet altar hangings, and the special violet and rose vestments for the priest. "It does me good to hope, and also to believe firmly," Suor Maria Celeste wrote to Galileo on December 3rd, "that His Lordship the Ambassador, when he departs from Rome, will be bringing you the news of your dispatch, and also word that he personally will conduct you here in his company. I do not believe that I will live to see that day. May it please the Lord to grant me this grace, if it be for the best." Suor Maria Celeste's fear of not living to see Galileo's return might have stemmed from some morbid presentiment regarding her indifferent health. But more likely, it arose from her frustration at the innumerable delays and rumors bearing false hope. "I understand everyone in Florence is saying you will soon be here," she wrote the following week, "but until I have this from your lips, all I will believe is that your dear friends are allowing their affections and desires to give themselves voice." This time, however, the hearsay held true. Urban had condescended at last to change Galileo's place of imprisonment to Arcetri, not so much to commute his sentence as to make it harsher, since the ambience at Siena approached that of an exclusive salon. The Pope's recommendation to the Holy Office stipulated that Galileo be limited in his social contacts henceforward, and that he refrain ever after from all teaching activities. Under these conditions, he now would be allowed to go home. "Most beloved Lord Father, only a moment before the news of your dispatch reached me, sire, I had taken my pen in hand to write to her ladyship the ambassadress to beg her once more to intercede in this affair. For having watched it wear on so long, I feared that it might not be resolved even by the end of this year, and thus my sudden joy was as great as it was unexpected. Nor are your daughters alone in our rejoicing, but all these nuns, by their grace, give signs of true happiness, just as so many of them have sympathized with me in my suffering. We are awaiting your arrival with great longing, and we cheer ourselves to see how the weather has cleared for your journey. Signor Geri was leaving this morning with the court for the annual winter session at Pisa, and I made sure to have him notified before daybreak of your return, sire, seeing as he had already learned something of the decision, and came here last evening to tell me what he knew. I also explained to him the reason you have not written to him, sire, and I bemoaned the fact that he will not be here when you arrive to share in our celebration, since he is truly a perfect gentleman, honest and loyal. I set aside the container of Verdea wine, which Signor Francesco could not bring along because his litter was too overloaded. You will be able to send it to the Archbishop later when the litter makes a return trip. The citron candy morsels I have already consigned to him. The casks for the white wine are all in order. More I cannot say for the dearth of time, except that all of us send you our loving regards. From San Mateo, the 10th day of December, 1633. Your most affectionate daughter, Suor Maria Celeste. Here she was, rushing to get her last letter to her father into the hands of Signor Francesco Lupi, Suor Maria Vincenzia's brother-in-law, before his litter rumbled off to Rome by way of Siena. Although the Nicolinis could not accompany Galileo back to Arcetri as they had intended, Galileo indeed returned by the end of the week. Grand Duke Ferdinando came in person to Il Gioiello to welcome him back and stayed to visit for 2 hours. They spoke of life and honor, and how Galileo had preserved his against formidable odds to become even more esteemed in his patron's eyes. If Ferdinando's fidelity to Galileo had fluttered briefly during the trial in response to Urban's threats, the future would find him a more steadfast friend. On December 17th, Galileo wrote a formal letter of thanks to his most highly placed supporter in Rome, Francesco Cardinal Barberini. "I have always taken special note of how affectionately Your Eminence has empathized with me in the events that befell me, and I especially recognize the value of your intercession in ultimately securing for me the grace of my being allowed to return to the quiet of my villa, precisely as I wanted to do. This, and 1,000 other kindnesses, all originating from your benign hand, confirm in me the wish, no less than the obligation, to always serve and revere Your Eminence, whenever it may please you to honor me with your command. Not having such an order from you at the moment, I render the requisite thanks for the favor received, which I so fervently desired. And with the most respectful love, I bow to you and kiss your robe, wishing you every happiness this most holy Christmas." In truth, Galileo was not so much home now as under perpetual house arrest. Later he would dateline his letters from my prison in Arcetri. He was forbidden to receive any visitors who might discuss scientific ideas with him. Nor could he go anywhere except to the neighboring convent, where the private reunion with his daughters revealed the true emotional cost to Suor Maria Celeste of the long, anxious separation. She had been frequently ill, he discovered, but had paid too little attention to herself. Galileo might have expected her to regain her stamina now in the relief of his repatriation and the sudden respite from responsibility for his affairs, but instead she grew weaker. "Most of all, I am distressed by the news of Suor Maria Celeste," Niccolo Aggiunti wrote from Pisa when Galileo told him of her condition. "I know the fatherly and daughterly affection which exists between you. I know the lofty intellect and the wisdom, prudence, and goodness with which your daughter is endowed, and I know of no one who in the same way as she remained your unique and gentle comforter in your tribulations." For months, she had dropped all talk of entering the other life to focus only on having her father return to his home and their life together. But now it seemed that both those prayers might be answered simultaneously. In the weakened state she had described so often, Suor Maria Celeste easily succumbed to one of the many contaminants in the food or water supply. Toward the end of March 1634, she fell gravely ill with dysentery. From the moment she took sick, Galileo walked from Il Gioiello to San Matteo every day, trying to hold on to her with love and prayer. The disease cursed her with intense, unremitting abdominal pain. Her inflamed intestines evacuated fluids indiscriminately, some blood along with the vital water, until she became dehydrated. The tiny amounts of broth she could swallow would not revive her, and finally the whole balance of her body tipped against her heart. Despite the best efforts of Dr. Ronconi and Suor Luisa to save her, she died during their vigil on the second night of April. Galileo's grief felled him. For months he sought his only solace in reading religious poems and dialogues. "The death of Suor Maria Celeste still tears at my heart," the ambassadress Caterina Nicolini said in condolences sent from Rome on April 22nd. "Like the love I bore her on account of her most virtuous nature, as well as those traits she inherited from your lordship, with whom I sympathize completely in this torment and in all else you have suffered." The Archbishop of Siena apologized that he could find no words to console his friend on the loss of such a daughter, but he tried to nevertheless, and he counseled Galileo to summon all his forbearance and strength for this current trial. "I have known for a long time that she was the greatest good your lordship had in this world," the archbishop wrote, "and of such towering personal importance as to merit more than paternal love. But her having employed her spirit in the service of the next life now grants her the privilege of that singular charity, enabling her to transcend our human plight so that she deserves to be envied rather than pitied." Geri Bocchineri rued the irony that Suor Maria Celeste, truly worthy of living for centuries, had followed the all-too-human course of dying young. "A father who turns his tender love toward a most virtuous, most reverend daughter," Signor Geri wrote Galileo, "cannot deny himself the full expression of his loss at her departure. Of necessity his tears must fall. But your lordship can cherish the hope that a maiden so good and holy will make her way straight to the Lord God and pray for you there before him, and so you may reconcile yourself to that encounter and be consoled rather than rail against the death that has placed her in heaven, for I believe we will need to entreat her far more than she will ever need our prayers. Always have I admired and esteemed her, and never once did I leave her presence without feeling edified, moved, contrite. Surely, blessed God has already gathered her into his arms." As Galileo received the comfort of these words, he still suffered the effects of his physical frailties, including the aggravation of his hernia. These problems mixed with his unhappiness to produce an irregular pulse and heart palpitations. "I feel immense sadness and melancholy," Galileo confided to Signor Geri at the end of April, "together with extreme inappetite. I am hateful to myself, and continually hear my beloved daughter calling to me." Galileo's son, Vincenzo, chose this difficult moment to make his own pilgrimage to the Casa Santa in Loreto, and from there to assume a series of law clerkships outside Florence against his father's objections. "I do not think it proper that Vincenzo should leave me for his travels," the bereft father complained to Signor Geri, "since from one hour to the other something might happen which would make his presence useful, because, in addition to all this mourning and sickness, a perpetual sleeplessness makes me afraid." In July, in a letter to Elia Deodati in Paris, Galileo explained Suor Maria Celeste's death in the context of his punishment and limited future. "I stayed 5 months at Siena in the house of the archbishop, after which my prison was changed to confinement to my own house, that little villa a mile from Florence, with strict injunctions that I was not to entertain friends, nor to allow the assembling of many at a time. Here I lived on very quietly, frequently paying visits to the neighboring convent, where I had 2 daughters who were nuns, and whom I loved dearly, but the eldest in particular, who was a woman of exquisite mind, singular goodness, and most tenderly attached to me. She had suffered much from ill health during my absence, but had not paid much attention to herself. At length, dysentery came on, and she died after 6 days' illness, leaving me in deep affliction. And by a sinister coincidence, on returning home from the convent, in company with the doctor who had just told me her condition was hopeless and she would not survive the next day, as indeed came to pass, I found the Inquisitor's vicar here, who informed me of a mandate of the Holy Office at Rome that I must desist from asking for grace, or they would take me back to the actual prison of the Holy Office, from which I can infer that my present confinement is to be terminated only by that other one which is common to all, most narrow and enduring forever." Into Galileo's morbid house at this juncture, his widowed sister-in-law, Anna Chiara Galilei, brought 3 daughters and her youngest son, Michelangelo, only to perish there with them during a brief reprise of the plague in 1634. Then Galileo, in his loneliness, invited another son of Anna Chiara's to stay with him, Alberto, Suor Maria Celeste's adorable little Albertino, who now worked as violinist and lutenist to the Elector in Germany. The two men comforted each other for a time at Il Gioiello, until Alberto went back to Munich to marry. Now, there was nothing for Galileo to do but lose himself in his work. In August, he resumed active correspondence with fellow mathematicians, and in the autumn, he reopened the unfinished manuscript for Two New Sciences. Chapter 32. As I Struggle to Understand. The experience of resuming with Salviati, Sagredo, and Simplicio, at age 70, the topics that had engaged him since his first awakening as a philosopher, doubly challenged Galileo. On the one hand, his ever-accumulating wisdom helped him regard certain ancient concepts in fresh ways, and this delayed his bringing the long unfinished work to closure even now. "The treatise on motion, all new, is in order," he wrote to an old friend in Venice, "but my unquiet mind will not rest from mulling it over with great expenditure of time, because the latest thought to occur to me about some novelty makes me throw out much already found there." On the other hand, his accumulated years hampered the alacrity of his thought. "I find how much old age lessens the vividness and speed of my thinking," Galileo wrote Elia Diodati while completing Two New Sciences, "as I struggle to understand quite a lot of things I discovered and proved when I was younger." But where and how would he publish the product of all this effort? Certainly not in Rome or Florence. Shortly before Galileo returned to Arcetri, Pope Urban had issued a companion warning to the banning of the dialogue, outlawing the reprinting of any of Galileo's earlier books. This action ensured that Galileo's works would gradually die out in Italy, where the Holy Office exerted its greatest influence. "You have read my writings," Galileo complained of the prohibition against him to another correspondent in France, "and from them you have certainly understood which was the true and real motive that caused, under the lying mask of religion, this war against me that continually restrains and undercuts me in all directions, so that neither can help come to me from outside, nor can I go forth to defend myself, there having been issued an express order to all inquisitors that they should not allow any of my works to be reprinted, which had been printed many years ago, or grant permission to any new work that I would print. A most rigorous and general order, I say, against all my works, omnia edita et edenda, everything published and everything I might have published in the future. So that it is left to me only to succumb in silence under the flood of attacks, exposures, derision, and insult coming from all sides." Galileo's friend, Fra Fulgenzio Micanzio, theologian to the Venetian Republic, thought he could get around the pontifical warnings to see Two New Sciences published in the more liberal atmosphere at Venice. Fra Micanzio soon discovered in preliminary conversations with the Venetian inquisitor, however, that Galileo faced the same obstacles there as in any other Italian duchy or papal state, that even the Credo or the Lord's Prayer might well be refused a printing license if Galileo were the one to seek it. There ensued a multinational effort among Galileo's supporters to find a printer somewhere who could translate and safely publish Two New Sciences. Geneva-born Parisian Elia Diodati hoped at first to see this happen in France, in the city of Lyon, the home of Galileo's distant relative, Roberto Galilei, a businessman who facilitated all French correspondence with the Italian scientist. However, Galileo soon had another offer of publication help in 1635 from an Italian engineer working for the Holy Roman Emperor and eager to have Two New Sciences printed in Germany. Grand Duke Ferdinando voluntarily lent his aid to this plan, commissioning his brother Prince Mattia, who was conveniently just leaving for Germany on a military mission, to hand-deliver sections of the contraband manuscript to Galileo's contact there. Alas, Father Christoph Scheiner, the Jesuit astronomer, formerly known as Apelles, had returned to Germany by this point, strengthening the anti-Galileo feelings in that country and making the licensing of the new book there highly unlikely. At the end of various intrigues, Diodati found Galileo a Dutch publisher, Louis Elsevier, who visited him at Il Gioiello in May of 1636 to settle their agreement. Although Galileo was now technically forbidden to receive visitors, Elsevier numbered among several distinguished foreign callers, including philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who came after reading an unauthorized English translation of the dialogue, and poet John Milton. Fra Micanzio in Venice, who knew both parties to the publishing contract, volunteered to serve as conduit between Arcetri and Holland. This gave the old theologian the pleasure of reading two new sciences in installments as each finished part reached him. "I see that you took the trouble to transcribe these in your own hand," Fra Micanzio once remarked with surprise upon receipt of certain pages, "and I don't see how you can stand it, for to me it would be absolutely impossible." While Galileo refined the main themes, he also expanded the content of the book to include some seemingly unrelated sections. After all, who knew when he would ever secure another opportunity to publish anything? "I shall send as soon as possible this treatise on projectiles," Galileo promised in December 1636, while finalizing day 4 of two new sciences, "along with an appendix 25 pages long on some demonstrations of certain conclusions about the centers of gravity of solids found by me at the age of 22 after 2 years of study of geometry, for it is good that these not be lost." In June of 1637, Galileo sent off the last pieces of dialogue for two new sciences, which ended with Sagredo's hopeful allusion to other discussion meetings the trio might enjoy in the future. Printing began at Leiden, Holland, that fall, and the published volume came out the following spring. Safe in a Protestant country, the Dutch publisher feared no reprisal from the Roman Inquisition. Galileo, however, remaining vulnerable in Arcetri, claimed ignorance of the book's publication until the ultimate moment. Even in his dedicatory note to French ambassador François de Noailles, he feigned surprise at how his manuscript had found its way to a foreign printing press. "I recognize, as resulting from Your Excellency's magnanimity, the disposition you have been pleased to make of this work of mine," Galileo wrote in a preface dated March 6, 1638. "Notwithstanding the fact that I myself, as you know, being confused and dismayed by the ill fortune of my other works, had resolved not to put before the public any more of my labors. Yet in order that they might not remain completely buried, I was persuaded to leave a manuscript copy in some place, that it might be known at least to those who understand the subjects of which I treat. And thus having chosen, as the best and loftiest such place, to put this into Your Excellency's hands, I felt certain that you, out of your special affection for me, would take to heart the preservation of my studies and labors. Hence, during your passage through this place on your return from your Roman embassy, when I was privileged to greet you in person, as I had so often greeted you before by letters, I had occasion to present to you the copy that I then had ready of these two works. You benignly showed yourself very much pleased to have them, to be willing to keep them securely, and by sharing them in France with any friend of yours who is apt in these sciences, to show that although I remain silent, I do not therefore pass my life in entire idleness. I was later preparing some other copies to send to Germany, Flanders, England, Spain, and perhaps also to some place in Italy, when I was notified by the Elseviers that they had these works of mine in press, and that I must therefore decide about the dedication and send them promptly my thoughts on that subject. From this unexpected and astonishing news, I concluded that it had been Your Excellency's wish to elevate and spread my name by sharing various of my writings that accounted for their having come into the hands of those printers who, being engaged in the publication of other works of mine," letter to the Grand Duchess Christina, "wished to honor me by bringing these also to light at their handsome and elaborate press. Now that matters have arrived at this stage, it is certainly reasonable that in some conspicuous way I should show myself grateful by recognizing Your Excellency's generous affection, for it is you who have thought to increase my fame by having these works spread their wings freely under an open sky, when it appeared to me that my reputation must surely remain confined within narrower spaces." Around the same time he wrote this fictitious scenario, Galileo appealed to the Holy Office for permission to seek medical treatment in Florence. Urban's brother, Antonio Cardinal Sant'Onofrio, sternly denying this request via the Florentine Inquisitor, ruled that Galileo had not described his illness in enough detail to be granted such an indulgence. Furthermore, the cardinal imagined Galileo's return to the city would give him the opportunity of having meetings, conversations, and discussions in which he might once again let his condemned opinions on the motion of the earth come to light. Galileo's failing health forced him to persist in this pursuit, however, and after he submitted to a surprise medical examination demanded by the Inquisition, he won the right to repair temporarily to Vincenzo's house on the Costa San Giorgio. On March 6th, Cardinal Sant'Onofrio told the Inquisitor at Florence that Galileo may let himself be moved from the villa at Arcetri, where he now is, to his house in Florence in order to be cured of his maladies. But I give your eminence orders that he must not go out into the city and not have public or secret conversations at his house. From the city, Galileo petitioned again, asking allowance to be carried in his chair by his family over the few steps he could not walk in his present state to hear Mass at the neighborhood church of San Giorgio. In the spirit of Easter, Cardinal Sant'Onofrio then instructed the Florentine Inquisitor, according to his own judgment, to give Galileo permission to attend Mass on feast days in the nearest possible church, provided that he does not have personal contacts. Galileo returned to Arcetri later in the spring of 1638, before two new sciences came off the printing press at Leiden. Somehow, his title for the book got changed, if not in translation, perhaps in translocation or by editorial fiat. Its title page names it: Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations Concerning Two New Sciences Pertaining to Mechanics and Local Motions by Signor Galileo Galilei, Lynxian Philosopher and Chief Mathematician to His Serene Highness the Grand Duke of Tuscany, with an appendix on the center of gravity in various solids. No record remains of Galileo's original title, but only his later lament over the substitution of a low and common title for the noble and dignified one he had selected. Nevertheless, the book sold briskly when it appeared in June of 1638. Weeks passed after its publication before Galileo himself received even a single copy. And by the time it reached his hands, he could not read or even see it. His eyes, vulnerable to infections and strains that had pained him much of his life, were now ruined by a combination of cataracts and glaucoma. The blindness took first his right eye in July 1637, forcing him to abandon his work on a fifth day to Two New Sciences, and then the left the next winter. During the gloaming time, when he had only one eye with which to observe the heavens or peruse his earlier notes and drawings, he wrote a final brief treatise on how best to gauge the diameters of stars and the distances between celestial bodies, and also made his last astronomical discovery regarding the librations or rocking of the moon. "I have discovered a very marvelous observation in the face of the moon," Galileo wrote to Venetian Fra Micanzio in November of 1637, "in which body, though it has been looked at infinitely many times, I do not find that any change was ever noticed, but that the same face was always seen the same to our eyes." The moon indeed keeps the same face, that of a smiling man's eyes, nose, and mouth, always turned toward the earth. For although the moon rotates about its axis as it revolves around the earth, the time period of its rotation precisely matches the monthly period of its revolution, keeping the far side out of sight. Around the fringes of the moon's face, however, a combination of curious effects affords occasional glimpses of parts otherwise unseen. "It alters its aspect," Galileo told Fra Micanzio, "like one who shows to our eyes his full face, head on, so to speak, and then goes changing this in all possible ways, that is, turning now a bit to the right and then a bit to the left, or else nodding up and down, or finally tilting his left shoulder to right and left. All these variations are seen in the face of the moon, and the large and ancient spots perceived in it make manifest and sensible what I say." When the total darkness descended, Galileo tried to accept the loss of his sight gracefully, remarking how no son of Adam had seen farther than he. Still, the irony overwhelmed him. "This universe," he railed to Elia Diodati in 1638, "which I with my astonishing observations and clear demonstrations had enlarged 100, nay, 1,000-fold beyond the limits commonly seen by wise men of all centuries past, is now for me so diminished and reduced, it has shrunk to the meager confines of my body. Chapter 33. The Memory of the Sweetnesses. While Galileo grew old and bent under house arrest in Arcetri, prohibited by inquisitors and infirmities from leaving Il Gioiello, the priest assigned to San Matteo visited him once a month, the convent records show, presumably to hear his confession and administer the sacrament of the Eucharist. Thus enfeebled, Galileo welcomed the October 1638 arrival of the perfect live-in companion, Vincenzo Viviani, a Florentine youth of 16 years with a remarkable aptitude for mathematics. His scholastic distinction had brought the boy to the attention of Grand Duke Ferdinando, who in turn commended him to Galileo as an assistant. Viviani wrote Galileo's letters for him, read aloud the responses, and helped Galileo reconstruct his earliest scientific investigations to clarify questions raised by correspondence. The biography of Galileo that Viviani began writing years later, in 1654, suggests a timeless period of pleasant hours shared by these two alone, when the old man would unleash his tongue to ramble and the young one would listen with all his might. It was Viviani who pursued, perpetuated, and all but mythologized certain pivotal moments in the story of Galileo's life. How, for example, while still a medical student, he intuited the law of the pendulum from watching a lamp swing during Mass in the Pisan Cathedral, and how he dropped cannonballs from the summit of the Leaning Tower to crowds of professors and students below. If Galileo warmed to Viviani as to a second son, he also enjoyed the attentions of his actual son through these last years, Vincenzo, now the father of three boys. The youngest, Cosimo, was born in 1636, visited Galileo in Arcetri, and most likely Suor Arcangela as well, who lived on in silence at the convent next door. When Galileo conceived the idea for harnessing the pendulum as the regulator for a mechanical clock, he discussed the project at length with his son, appealing to Vincenzo for the use of his sight and artistic skill in drawing the clockwork. The sketch completed, Vincenzo offered to build the working model himself rather than let the idea fall into the hands of some competitor who might pirate Galileo's invention. In a description he later wrote of his father, Vincenzo mixed memories of such times with hagiography. Galileo was of jovial aspect, in particular in old age, of proper and square stature, of robust and strong complexion, as such that is necessary to support the really Atlantic efforts he endured in the endless celestial observations. His eloquence and expressiveness were admirable. Talking seriously, he was extremely rich of sentences and deep concepts. In the pleasing discourses, he did not lack wit and jokes. He was easily angered, but more easily calmed. He had an extraordinary memory, so that, in addition to the many things connected to his studies, he had in mind a great quantity of poetry, and in particular the better part of Orlando Furioso, his favorite among the poems, of whose author, Ludovico Ariosto, he praised above all the Latin and Tuscan poets. His most detested vice was the lie, maybe because, with the help of the mathematical science, he knew the beauty of the truth too well. In 1641, Benedetto Castelli, through persistent petitioning of the Holy Office, obtained permission to come to Arcetri and study the motions of the Jovian moons with his old teacher, as well as to advise him spiritually, with the caveat that any discussion of the earth's motion would be grounds for excommunication. "The falsity of the Copernican system must not on any account be doubted," Galileo affirmed in his correspondence at this time, "especially by us Catholics, who have the irrefragable authority of Holy Scripture interpreted by the greatest masters in theology, whose agreement renders us certain of the stability of the earth and the mobility of the sun around it. The conjectures of Copernicus and his followers offered to the contrary are all removed by that most sound argument taken from the omnipotence of God. He being able to do in many, or rather in infinite ways, that which to our view and observation seems to be done in one particular way, we must not pretend to hamper God's hand and tenaciously maintain that in which we may be mistaken." And just as I deem inadequate the Copernican observations and conjectures, so I judge equally and more fallacious and erroneous those of Ptolemy, Aristotle, and their followers, when, without going beyond the bounds of human reasoning, their inconclusiveness can be very easily discovered. Upon Castelli's return to Rome, he resumed his efforts to see Galileo's sentence of house arrest commuted, though these proved unsuccessful. Castelli continued to say Mass for Galileo every morning, until his own death in 1643, and the two close friends kept in touch on matters of mutual interest. Concluding a letter to Castelli on the hydraulics of fountains and rivers, Galileo expressed gratitude for the solace of his companionship over a lifetime. "Bereft of my powers by my great age, and even more by my unfortunate blindness and the failure of my memory and other senses, I spend my fruitless days, which are so long because of my continuous inactivity, and yet so brief compared with all the months and years which have passed, and I am left with no other comfort than the memory of the sweetnesses of former friendships, of which so few are left, although one more undeserved than all the others remains, that of corresponding in love with you." Still, Galileo's imagination would not rest, but returned to the longitude problem, to the books of Euclid, whose ancient definitions of ratios Galileo redefined at this time, as well as to any number of other ideas he may have entertained, but neither recorded nor reported to anyone. "I have in mind a great many miscellaneous problems and questions," he wrote to a fellow philosopher in Savona, "partly quite new and partly different from or contrary to those commonly received, of which I could make a book more curious than the others written by me. But my condition, besides blindness, on top of other serious indispositions, and a decrepit age of 75 years, will not permit me to occupy myself in study. I shall therefore remain silent, and so pass what remains to me of my laborious life, satisfying myself in the pleasure I shall feel from the discoveries of other pilgrim minds." One such roving intellect, the self-pronounced Galileist Evangelista Torricelli, who had been one of Castelli's most precocious students in Rome, sent Galileo a letter and a manuscript for comment. Impressed, Galileo invited him to Arcetri. "I hope to enjoy your company for some few days before my life, now near an end, is finished," Galileo wrote to Torricelli in September 1641, "as also to discuss with you some relics of my thoughts on mathematics and physics, and to have your aid in polishing them, that they may be left less messy to be seen with other things of mine." Torricelli moved into Galileo's house in October. The very next month, however, Galileo took to his canopy bed with a fever and pain in his kidneys that presently proved fatal. As he lay dying for more than 2 months, Galileo had time to dictate to Torricelli some thoughts in dialogue on mathematical ratios. It was the beginning of a new book, another intellectual adventure for Salviati, Sagredo, and Simplicio. But it was too late. On the evening of January 8, 1642, Galileo died in the quiet company of Torricelli, Viviani, and his own Vincenzo. "Today the news has come of the loss of Signor Galilei," wrote Lucas Holst, Francesco Cardinal Barberini's Vatican librarian, "which touches not just Florence, but the whole world, and our whole century, which from this divine man has received more splendor than from almost all the other ordinary philosophers. Now, envy ceasing, the sublimity of that intellect will begin to be known, which will serve all posterity as guide in the search for truth." Though Holst's eulogy would eventually prove prophetic, the lingering effects of Galileo's trial and condemnation subdued the immediate reaction to his death. Grand Duke Ferdinando, dubbing Galileo the greatest light of our time, buried him in the novices' chapel in the Franciscan Church of Santa Croce. Ferdinando had hoped to honor the wishes expressed in Galileo's will, that he be buried next to his father and other relatives in the church's main basilica, which was padded with private chapels bearing the tombs and coats of arms of many of Florence's finest families. Beyond this, the Grand Duke had proposed a public funeral oration, and the erection of a marble mausoleum, but Pope Urban called down from Rome to check all these attempts. Any such fuss over the dead body of Galileo, Urban announced with an anger that he took to his own grave, would be deemed an offense against papal authority. Ferdinando submitted to the Pope's decree. He dropped the idea of the monument, and eschewing the burial site inside the basilica, he had Galileo's body interred in a closet-sized room off the chapel under the campanile, where he naturally assumed it would stay. But the 19-year-old Viviani, with a dedication born of devotion, committed himself to moving and correctly commemorating his mentor's mortal remains someday, somehow. Though Vincenzo Galilei was heir to his father's financial estate, except for an annuity of 35 scudi set aside for the lifelong support of Sua Arcangela, Vincenzo Viviani inherited the master's mathematics. Having studied as Galileo's pupil, Viviani succeeded Torricelli in 1647 in his teacher's former post as mathematician to Grand Duke Ferdinando. And having served as Galileo's amanuensis, Viviani later gathered all of his papers to publish in 1656 the first edition of the collected works of Galileo, without the dialogue, of course. Ferdinando de' Medici and his brother Prince Leopold inducted Viviani as a charter member of their scientific society, the Accademia del Cimento, which began holding regular meetings at the Pitti Palace in 1657. That honor, coupled with the luster of his own published books on mathematics, helped spread Viviani's fame so that King Louis XIV appointed him one of only 8 foreign members of the newly founded French Académie Royale des Sciences in 1666. All this time, Viviani never slackened his resolve to resuscitate the plans for the monument and public recognition of Galileo. He received scant assistance from Galileo's family, understandably, for Vincenzo died of a fever in 1649, and Suor Arcangela, though she survived another 10 years after her brother's death, could not have been any help. Viviani found a sculptor to create Galileo's death mask, and from it a bust. Later, he commissioned a different sculptor to fashion a second bust in bronze, then a marble version from yet another artist whom he charged to design the still-forbidden tomb. Viviani assumed all responsibility for the execution and expense of these efforts, trying simultaneously to convince influential persons of their importance. He lost Ferdinando's support in 1670, when the Grand Duke's 5-decade reign ended in an agony of dropsy, apoplexy, and the painful treatments of his doctors. Viviani turned hopefully to the new heir to the throne, Ferdinando's son, the gluttonous, sanctimonious Cosimo III. But he proved to be an ineffectual leader with no interest in science, who taxed the Florentines unfairly as he squandered what remained of the Medici fortune. In Rome, Urban's immediate successors, Innocent X for 10 years, followed by Alexander VII for 12, focused their funerary attention on their own lavish tombs. In September 1674, in frustration, Viviani mounted a marble plaque and a plaster bust on the wall of the tiny room off the novitiate's chapel where Galileo still lay in a virtually unmarked grave. He followed this action with a unique public yet private tribute by renovating the facade of his own new house to accommodate a bust of Galileo over the arched front doorway, with eulogies to him inscribed in enormous stone scrolls on either side. When Viviani died childless in 1703, at the age of 81, he left all his worldly goods, including the solemn responsibility for relocating Galileo's grave, in the hands of a nephew who never accomplished the plan in the remaining 3 decades of his own life. Viviani's property, along with the duty it implied, passed eventually by family inheritance to a senator of Florence, Giovanni Battista Clemente de' Neri, who enjoyed the triumphant satisfaction of finally seeing the Galileo tomb project through to completion in 1737, thanks in part to the accession of Lorenzo Corsini as Pope Clement XII. With a Florentine pontiff once more ensconced on the throne of St. Peter, Galileo would finally claim his proper due. The mausoleum had first taken form in Ferdinando's and Viviani's envisionings as a match for the ornate monument to Michelangelo Buonarroti, another fellow Tuscan, near the entrance to Santa Croce. There, against the south wall of the church, Michelangelo's highly perched bust oversees the marble forms of the muses of painting, sculpture, and architecture who sit around his coffin in mourning. Not only did Ferdinando and Viviani view Galileo's genius as the scientific counterpoint to Michelangelo's art, but Viviani also promulgated the belief that Michelangelo's spirit had leaped like an inspiration from his aged, failing body to the infant Galileo in the brief span of hours separating the former's death from the latter's birth. The original design for Galileo's monument called for three female forms to attend him, the muses of astronomy, geometry, and philosophy, who would stand symmetrically opposed to Michelangelo's three-seated muses of the arts. In the tomb's eventual execution, however, only two such statues, astronomy and geometry, emerged to flank the bust of Galileo, who holds in his right hand a telescope, while his left rests on a globe and an assortment of books. Philosophy was omitted, either on instructions from the Holy Office or out of fear that her presence would recall unfortunate memories of Galileo's condemnation. And yet there is a third female figure incorporated into the tomb, in such a way that she remains invisible to even the most careful observer. On the evening of March 12, 1737, after permission had been granted to move Galileo's body from its first interment site to the marble sarcophagus of the nearly completed monument, a distinguished congregation, part ecclesiastic, mostly civic, assembled discreetly with torches and candles in the church of Santa Croce. Their task that long night involved elements of demolition work, religious ceremony, mortuary identification, and hero veneration as they exhumed the body of Galileo. This occasion also saw the ritual removal of a single vertebra from the venerated scientist, along with three fingers of his right hand and a tooth, and surely would have included the preservation of his brain as well, if by some miracle that organ had still survived. The closet-sized room under the campanile, where Galileo had lain buried for 95 years, now contained two brick biers, one belonging to Galileo and the other to his disciple, Vincenzo Viviani, who had asked in his will to share the master's grave. The few men who could fit inside the tiny room broke open the more recent brickwork laid at the time of Viviani's death in 1703 and extracted a wood coffin. According to an eyewitness report filed by a notary, they carried this into the novices' chapel, where everyone could watch as the lid was lifted to reveal a lead plate identifying the corpse as Viviani's. Several sculptors and scientists in the party covered the bier with a black cloth, and lifting the draped coffin to their shoulders, they bore it through the long passageway from the chapel and across the cavernous basilica. Their chanted prayers for the dead reverberated off the wooden columns which towered over the unattended procession and the stone walls that had been frescoed by Giotto to trace the life of St. Francis. The assembly placed the body at the new site, then returned to the little chapel and set about repeating the procedure, smashing the older brick container under the 1674 memorial Viviani had mounted for Galileo, and pulling out another wooden coffin. This one had apparently been damaged over time, its lid bashed in and littered with broken pieces of plaster. As the men dragged the bier from the bricks, they were startled to discover another almost identical wooden box lying directly beneath it. Galileo's grave contained two coffins, two skeletons, and no lead nameplate on either one of them. Panic, no doubt, gripped several hearts at the prospect of being unable to decide which body deserved to be deposited in the new monument. But when the Grand Duke's chief physician, accompanied by several professors of anatomy, stepped forward to examine the evidence, they accomplished their identification with reassuring ease. Only one of the skeletons could possibly have belonged to Galileo, the top one, because its bones were those of an old man, with the detached mandible containing only four teeth. The skeleton in the lower coffin, the experts all concurred, was unmistakably female. Although the woman had lain dead for at least as long a time as the man, if not longer, she had died at a much younger age. The congregation divided itself solemnly in half, each group walking Galileo's body partway through the basilica, so that as many participants as possible could share the honor of being his pallbearers. Then they carried the woman to the mausoleum too, and they laid her in the sepulchre beside her father. Once the shock of the discovery had dissipated into the silence of the great empty church, those attendants who remembered Viviani could unfurl the mystery for themselves. The disciple, driven to despair by his failure to pay the tribute he felt he owed his master, had given Galileo something dearer than bronze or marble to distinguish his grave. even now. No inscription on Galileo's much-visited tomb in Santa Croce announces the presence of Suor Maria Celeste. But still, she is there.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation. Production copyright 1999, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.